friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 131 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I am a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarvox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
Where you are always hiring.
Yes, and I'm the current interim chair applying for a full chair, so wish me luck. And if you would like to come work in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas and work with some wonderful residents and get to teach them and some medical students, take care of some really lovely patients, we'd love to have you.
I don't think you need luck. You're a shoo-in for this job, Michelle. Also joining us, of course, is the pimping bell. The pimping bell exists to highlight especially question-worthy or noteworthy content, so do pay attention when you hear the pimping bell sing. And of course, our job here on Dermasphere is to bring you discussions of some of the latest dermatologic research direct to your ears to hopefully save up some time in your day. And Michelle, you're going to lead us off here today.
I am. We're going to talk about something very interesting and also illustrative of the fact that living up to current beauty standards is very important to people. So this is an article out of the New England Journal of Medicine. It's a correspondence, and it's entitled Kidney Injury and Hair Straightening Products Containing Glyoxylic Acid. The chief authors of this publication are Thomas Robert, Ellie Tang, and Emmanuel Le Tavernier, I did not say that right. Le Tavernier, probably, because they have French, yeah. So Emmanuel Le Tavernier is probably correct. So these authors are from Marseille, France, and Paris, France. And they are discussing here a patient that unfortunately subjected themselves to multiple episodes of hair straightening treatments with multiple resultant episodes of kidney injury. So in this correspondence to the editor, they discuss the fact that hair treatments, especially those aimed at straightening or smoothing hair, have become very popular in recent decades. And recently, Benaya et al. Described in the literature 26 patients in Israel who had acute injury to their kidneys after a Brazilian hair straightening procedure. The authors hypothesized that the glycolic acid derivatives contained in the hair straightening products could be absorbed through the skin and then metabolized into oxalate by the liver that could cause calcium oxalate nephropathy. There is little evidence that glycolic acid, a component of many cosmetic products, can induce kidney injury after spontaneous transcutaneous absorption, but this case series sheds a little bit of suspicion on that. In this case report, they're not talking about glycolic acid, and remember, glycolic acid is something that's in a lot of skincare products. It's something that can be, of course, nephrotoxic, especially if taken systemically. Here they're talking about glyoxylic acid. So this is a case report of a 26-year-old Tunisian woman who had been previously healthy. She had three consecutive episodes of acute kidney injury, June 2020, April 2021, and July 2022. So roughly every year, she was getting these hair straightening treatments. Each time she presented with vomiting, diarrhea, fever, and back pain. And each time laboratory studies showed an increase in plasma creatinine level during each episode. CT scan did not indicate any obstructive uropathy, and urinalysis confirmed the presence of blood and leukocytes without proteinuria or infection. Kidney function improved rapidly after each episode, and the creatinine levels normalized. No crystallurea or stone analysis was performed, unfortunately, and whole exome sequencing analysis was negative for nephropathic genes. Each episode of acute kidney injury coincided with a hair treatment at the same salon on the day the symptoms began. So this is pretty convincing evidence that this is the cause of this kidney injury. The patient reported a burning sensation during each procedure, followed by scalp ulcers, but she went back multiple times for the same treatment. The cream used for the straightening procedure contained 10% glyoxylic acid, but no glycolic acid. So then the authors took things a step further. They also plotted her creatinine levels on an axis of time, along with each episode of exposure to the glyoxylic acid-containing hair straightening product, and you see a spike in her creatinine each time that that happens. So they took it to the next level, which was to show the possibility of this influencing mammalian homeostasis by applying it to mice. So they wanted to look at the potential mechanism for the nephropathy. They applied the straightening product and also a control cream to the backs of mice. So they had control mice that were lucky that just got the petroleum jelly. And then they had the experimental mice, which were unlucky that got the control cream. Spoiler alert. The urinalysis was then done on the mice the day after cream application. And in the mice that were exposed to the treatment cream that had the glyoxylic acid, they found elongated calcium oxalate monohydrate crystals similar to those observed after ethylene glycol intoxication. The mice that were exposed to the petroleum jelly, unsurprisingly, had no kidney abnormalities. The plasma creatinine level in the exposed mice increased significantly 28 hours after cutaneous application of the hair straightening cream. And then they did three-dimensional CT scans of the kidneys of the mice that showed the presence of dense tubule-molding calcium oxalate monohydrate crystals. No such deposits were seen in the control mice. And the...
Wait a second. It doesn't sound like the control mice were that lucky after all. Someone's looking at their kidneys.
Well, that's true. They probably did eventually... Well, they went through three-dimensional CT scans. The three-dimensional CT scans were pretty impressive in the kind of tubule molding crystals that were formed. Basically, the crystals filled every open space in the kidney. So this was relatively significant crystalline nephropathy. That's hard to say. The results here provide evidence that the hair straightening cream with the glyoxylic acid can be absorbed through the skin and can induce calcium oxalate induced nephropathy after hair straightening procedures of the type that the patient was exposed to. Glyoxylic acid was patented and introduced recently in hair straightening products after it was seemingly found to be safer as an alternative to formulations containing formaldehyde, which were the previous iteration of the Brazilian hair straightening treatments. In consideration,
none of them sound great.
I agree. In consideration
just
of the
have curly hair,
As you look at my curly mop on my head, you can see that I've abandoned the concept of straight hair. So the formaldehyde containing formulations, I will sadly admit, I did try. Probably about 10 years ago. And I found it to not be very kind to the hair, actually. I felt like the hair broke a lot afterwards, and it took me like a year for my hair to recover from that. So I generally don't love these treatments because I feel like they're not very gentle to the hairs. And here we're demonstrating they might even have some systemic risks. The nephrotoxicity of the topical glyoxylic acid and the also irritation that can be caused by these products point to the fact that these treatments should be avoided. So I think that there's a few things that are important out of this article. Thing number one is that just because a product is on the market does not mean that it's safe. And the regulation of the cosmetic industry is something that sort of catches catch can a little bit. Reports like this are extremely important in helping draw attention to unsafe products that are on the market. Hair straightening procedures that involve harsh chemicals are both potentially harmful to the hair and also potentially harmful to the organism that has grown the hair, whether that organism be a mouse or a human being. The straightening procedures also use very high levels of heat, and they might potentially also be aerosolizing some of these chemicals as well, which was a concern when the formaldehyde-containing preparations were on the market. So we would all hopefully ourselves, as well as advise our patients, to avoid hair straightening treatments with either glycolic acid or glyoxylic acid and also formaldehyde. I think that, you know, if you have textured hair, if you can embrace the beauty of the texture of your hair, that's probably the best way to handle things. I personally have learned to love my curls and leave them alone. And they're the most happy when I do that. They're like house cats. You leave them alone, they flourish. So I think a very important thing for us to know about and advise our patients on, and also a testament to how important fitting into beauty ideals is in modern society, especially in young patients.
It's also just kind of crazy that something you're applying to the hair, not really specifically to the scalp, can give you such kidney damage. What the heck?
I'm thinking that in this case, because she had scalp ulcers, perhaps there was a little bit of overzealous application of the product. But if any of these products do contact the skin, we know certain medications are intentionally absorbed through the skin. There are preparations of testosterone that are made to be absorbed through the skin. There are preparations of nitrous oxide that are designed to be absorbed through the skin. Our skin is a very important permeable organ of our body that's able to interface with our environment and sometimes, unfortunately, lets things in that we'd rather stay out.
So let's say I have a patient who gets wind of this article and says, so I really want to straighten my hair, but I was told that it could damage my kidneys. What product should I use? What do we tell them?
So there's a couple of different things that can be done to help improve hair texture temporarily. If you're looking for something more permanent, there are straight perms that can be done. Sodium thioglycolate is one of the chemicals that's used for that, has been used for a very long time. It does certainly have the potential to damage the hair shaft. There's not been, I think, a rash of kidney injuries reported with that product, but hopefully patients can find gentler ways to straighten their hair. There are also a lot of devices that use very precise levels of heat and very even heating plates. A lot of the straightening irons have a metal in them called tourmaline that really does tend to help disperse the heat and make it more even application, so you're less likely to have hot spots that can damage the hair. But for anybody with the goal to maintain long hair, what we call protective hairstyles on the regular are the best things. So things that put less tension on the hair, that don't cause a lot of compressive damage, that aren't going to cause a lot of pulling and twisting changes. You know, so conservative things like a loose gentle braid, the hair sort of half up in a loose clip. These kinds of things are better for protecting the hair's structure and also not having to use a lot of chemical additives to alter the hair's presentation.
Well, it sounds like that patient paid more than she expected when she went in and laid down her $50 for her hair straightening treatment. Speaking of cost, I want to talk about cost effectiveness. So this is an article out of the JID. It's a little bit old, from 2017, but this is a subject of interest to me, and one of the speakers at the AAD mentioned this article, and I thought it was real good, so I thought I'd bring it up. The title is Research Techniques Made Simple. That's like a series they have at the JID. Cost Effectiveness Analysis. The authors are Connie Shi and Vinod Nambudiri. Apologize if I mispronounced your name. They are out of Harvard. So as I frequently complain about on this podcast, many of our drugs are very expensive. Many of them are also very good. Mm-hmm. So how do we decide which ones to use? How much should we care? And which ones should we use to get the biggest bang for our buck? So cost effectiveness analysis is a approach that tries to at least provide a framework and some guidance for answering questions like these. And I'm also using this article as a little bit of a springboard to just soapbox about my own feelings on this issue to some degree. So not everything I say is going to be reflective of the author's opinions, but I'll try to do them justice here. So first, some definitions. So I think many of us have heard of a QALY. Michelle, you probably have heard of a QALY.
I have heard of a QALY.
QALY, pronounced QALY, stands for Quality Adjusted Life Year. And this is a year of life taking into account a patient's quality of life. So a value of 1.0 is a 1 year of life lived in perfect quality health. But if you have a bad disease that affects your quality of life, then maybe you have every year of yours is like 0.7 QALY, for example. A similar concept is the DALY. Hello, DALY, DALY.
I'm so proud of you for singing. That was amazing.
Oh, thank you. Yes, normally that's your bag, but
that was very
it
nice.
Stands for Disability Adjusted Life Year. So kind of the same deal, but taking into account disability rather than quality of life. We can also try to quantify lives saved or years of life saved, but those are, I think, thought to be more crude, which is why the concept of QALY and DALY appeared, right? You want to give somebody years of quality existence, not just extended life lived in misery with our treatments. And then there's also this concept called the Incremental Cost Effectiveness Ratio, or ICER. I'm going to repeat it. Incremental Cost Effectiveness Ratio. And it seems to be, I've heard the concept in sports of wins over replacement. Like if you've got a baseball team and you've got an average player and you have the opportunity to pay a bunch of money to hire a really good player to replace that guy, well, how much better does he actually make your team? The wins over replacement. And I don't play baseball. I play magic cards. And so a similar concept is if I paid $100 for some fancy magic card and I replaced my 50-cent card with that one, how much would it actually increase my win percentage? Is it worth it? And so this is the same deal. So, for example, our fancy new psoriasis drugs like the brand new bimekizumab certainly seems to be more effective than the somewhat old school adalimumab at treating psoriasis. But I guess that it's more expensive. So is it worth it? What is the ICER, the incremental cost effectiveness ratio of that medicine? And this is all cost effectiveness analysis. There's also cost benefit analysis, which is a little different because it looks exclusively at monetary issues. So how much does something cost and how much do we save? And so this one doesn't include human lives, quality of life, disability, suffering, and so on. So these are all pretty tricky waters. It's kind of hard to do these studies, which may be one reason why we haven't seen them more often. And again, some of this is just my own personal commentary. So for one, people may not agree on various metrics or their varying weights. So for example, there are different ways to measure quality of life, and you might feel that they do not accurately reflect the quality of life that somebody has one way or another, even though many of them have been validated. There are people out there who are offended by the idea of rationing healthcare, which a lot of these cost-effectiveness articles or analyses try to get at. Like, we're trying to get the biggest bang for our buck here, so one response might be, what are you talking about? So you're not going to treat my blankety blank because you don't think it's cost effective? That doesn't seem right. We're a rich country. Let's do it. And of course, most of us know that the truth is with it, we end up rationing healthcare one way or another. And it would be kind of nice if we did it in a more deliberate fashion, in my opinion. And we can also argue about the specific effects of some diseases on their quality of life and disability. And it's hard to argue that some people have different quality of life effects or disability effects that they experience differently than others. So I think about my alopecia areata patients, for example, patients with alopecia totalis. Some of them just don't care that they don't have hair, and some of them care a whole lot. And how much should we care about that? Should you get the drug because you happen to be somebody who's bothered by it? Should we just give everybody with alopecia universalis $60,000 a year and they can decide what they want to do with it? They can decide to buy a baricitinib or they can decide to go do something else? See, tricky questions. And including all of the costs in these analyses can be challenging and, again, sometimes controversial because you include not only the cost of the intervention, like how much does bimekizumab cost, but you also want to include any associated lab work, any potential adverse effects and their costs. You want to include patient travel time, people's time away from work and school, lost productivity, payments to medical professionals, of course, and to maintain the medical infrastructure, and so on. This reminds me a little bit of our conversation with Sabine Sommer. You probably pronounce her name slightly Sabine differently. Sabine Sommer. because she talked about that they're paying attention to like the carbon footprint that the patient applies while they're driving back to your office to have their sutures taken out or for their isotretinoin or cyclosporin follow-up. So do you include stuff like that if you're talking about how much it costs for a patient to be on isotretinoin, for example? Also to get to the lab. So, you know, I'm a minimalist when it comes to isotretinoin labs in particular. This is another argument against them. And also small adjustments to different values within your framework can make a big difference at the end. So for example, if an adverse effect has a real high chance of occurring, then the dollars per quality can go up significantly. This is a bit of a tangent, but it reminds me of the Drake equation. Michelle, do you know what the Drake equation is?
I'm presuming you're not referring to the rapper.
No. Francis Drake. He was like
the OG Drake. Okay.
The OG Drake. He was like an astronomer who came up with, it's more of a thought experiment, but it's referred to as the Drake equation, the probability that there's extraterrestrial life out there. And it's like you multiply the number of galaxies that exist in the universe times the number of planets times the percentage of those planets that could support life and so on and so on. And then just small changes to like, well, how many planets are actually in the solar system or I guess in a galaxy can make big differences to how the output of the Drake equation. And you can see how this could also be biased. So for example, I found some numbers that said the risk of pulmonary toxicity in a patient on methotrexate is 1-7%. So if I were writing an article and my idea was we should all be using methotrexate instead of fancy biologics because it's cheaper, then I would probably use like the 1% version of that range to emphasize that methotrexate's cheap. But if I wanted to do the opposite, then I could use the 7% range and then multiply that by the cost it would incur on society to pay for somebody's pulmonary toxicity and so forth. It's also hard because prices are constantly changing, so keeping track of this stuff can be difficult. Also, there are no universally accepted standards for cost-effectiveness thresholds. So what amount of money, for example, does our society think is acceptable to save one quality-adjusted life year? Historically, in the United States, $50,000 is often used. 1 year of perfect quality life is worth $50,000. But that's probably back from like the 80s, and I think that number was used because of dialysis. That was when it was decided that Medicare should pay for dialysis regardless of who you were, you know, under 65. Somehow, I don't know how this got through the government, but Medicare pays for dialysis regardless. And so society seemed to then implicitly suggest that it was worth saving somebody's life with dialysis. And it turns out that at least back then, it was $50,000 per quality for dialysis. But again, inflation has probably raised that up by now. I've also heard that $1 to $2 million is the de facto value for infrastructure improvements. So if you've got a highway and you are put a guardrail on it, or you paint reflective stripes down the line or something, then it does make it safer, but the odds of somebody crashing were already pretty low, so you ended up spending $1 million per quality. Mm-hmm. In the United Kingdom, it seems like $30,000 per quality is used by their governing bodies. The World Health Organization, the WHO, recommends that 3 times a nation's per capita gross domestic product would be reasonable. So the amount of money that a nation has in its economy, or that it makes every year, is called its gross domestic product. You divide that by the number of people in the nation, and you end up with the per capita gross domestic product. In the United States, that's $76,000 a year. So by the WHO's metric, that $50,000 would be grossly underpaying for a quality these days. For reference, by the way, the gross domestic product per capita in China is $13,000. In Japan, it's $34,000. In the UK, it's $46,000. So if you're ever feeling glum and you're in the United States, just keep in mind that our per capita GDP is pretty good. By the way, Michelle, what do you think has the lowest GDP per capita?
Ooh, I would hesitate to hazard a guess.
Well, you probably would guess it's a poor country in Africa, and you would be correct. It's Burundi. $260.
Wow.
Would you care to guess the highest?
Switzerland? I feel like it's got to be Switzerland.
Switzerland's a good guess. Switzerland's number 5. The highest is Luxembourg.
Luxembourg. I always forget about Luxembourg.
Yeah, everybody does, but you shouldn't, because they have the highest per capita GDP at $144,000 a year. Look at the range there, $260 to $144,000. So if the WHO's recommendations are to be taken at face value, I mean, this is part of the sad reality of the world in which we live. A human life in Luxembourg is worth way more than a human life in Burundi. Mm. We could argue about that as well, I suppose. And speaking of this cost-effectiveness stuff, I did read an article, or not an article, a whole book, once upon a time, called Donut Economics by a British economist named Kate Raworth, who argues against reducing everything to dollars. Not really what you would expect an economist to say, but just reducing everything to dollars can impact our moral and ethical framework for viewing problems. So an impact in terms of price, for example, can turn into a cost you are willing to pay. So her argument is that if we want to create a strip mall in some previously undespoiled countryside, our normal framework is just we get, you know, money. There's revenue now. There's jobs. There's people buying and selling stuff. So that's good. But it doesn't take into account the benefit that that area of forest had just by existing to, you know, humanity enjoying how a forest is and ecosystems and animals living there and stuff. So maybe we should say, well, let's keep in mind that if we want to build a strip mall, it's not all upside. We also think that this is currently worth $300,000 a year or whatever, and we should keep that in mind. But she says, well, that quickly turns into, I mean, I'm willing to pay $300,000 to get rid of that forest, no problem. And that strips the whole issue of its moral and ethical framework. Mm-hmm. So it's tricky, but I think this is all important to do. And this article outlines some examples of cost-effectiveness analysis in dermatology. So, for example, sunscreen use in Australia, there was a study in 2009 that compared people using, quote, heavy sunscreen versus, quote, routine use, and found that it was cost-effective to apply heavy sunscreen, lots of sunscreen all the time, because it prevented more non-melanoma skin cancers, and it prevented more actinic keratoses, and thus their treatment, which, of course, is costly. And to make the program cost effective, the government would need to invest 74 cents per person per year, which does not sound like very much. They do point out that in most or maybe all countries, people pay for their own sunscreen. But it's society and the government, which pays healthcare costs, that benefit significantly from not having to pay those costs. So obviously, I would also benefit because I wouldn't get skin cancer if I was using this heavy sunscreen stuff. But it does make the argument that we should do more to make such interventions accessible to people. Should we have the government just supply everybody with sunscreen? I don't know that I'd go that far, but again, making them more accessible. It makes me think about over-the-counter contraceptive pills, for example. I feel like making things accessible is probably a good idea. And another example in dermatology is advanced melanoma treatment. So apparently, trametinib plus dabrafenib is more effective at treating advanced melanoma than monotherapy with vemurafenib. But the ICER, the incremental cost-effectiveness ratio, is $380,000 per quali. So if you want to treat somebody with a more effective treatment, just know that it's way more expensive, and we as a society, I think, should be having a better dialogue at deciding whether or not it's worth it. And of course, costs change over time, as does our understanding, so everything's a moving target, which makes this all more challenging. Finally, the authors point out that cost-effectiveness analysis is increasingly included in clinical trials. At least that's what they say. I sure feel like I don't see it. Most of the time I see clinical trials talking about how great a drug is and almost nothing about its cost-effectiveness. But I would like to think that something like that is coming.
I like this idea.
So all of this is to say that first of all, it's tricky, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing it. And I would like to see more cost-effectiveness stuff included in our research and our thinking. I think we focus a lot of effort on developing awesome new drugs, and many of them are awesome. On the other hand, many of them are really not that awesome compared to what we have, and we should recognize the cost that some of these incur to us and our society.
I think those are very, very salient points to consider. And, you know, I'm always glad that I'm not the person that has to make the highest level decisions about, you know, where you draw the line with how much effort, energy, and money you expend trying to preserve and care for a single human life. Because, of course, the vow we all take would lead us probably to answer, you know, you do everything you can for each person. Realistically, you can't do that because resources are limited. So then you have to find ways to decide how to appropriately utilize those resources and be a good steward of them. That's got to be a very difficult thing to do. So I don't envy the people that have to make those decisions.
I think you would do a great job at it for what it's worth, Michelle.
That's very good.
Michelle for Healthcare Czar.
Oh my goodness. Well, Luke, I have something completely different for you.
But also pretty spicy, I understand. Let's hit it.
Oh, fun. Well, so I'm actually going to do an ode to botulinum toxins in the form you mentioned Drake earlier, so I shall do this in the form of a rap. Please forgive me in advance because this is obviously not my primary profession, but are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
All right, so an ode to botulinum toxin. Onobotulinum is the OG. Botox was the first tox in the country. Then abobotulinum toxin was another one. With Dysport, the tox battle had begun. Then incobotulinum toxin joined the fold, and you don't have to keep Xeomin cold. Then probobotulinum toxin hit the scene. Juvo was the next hot tox thing. Now daxibotulinum toxin may be stronger. Daxify seems to last just a bit longer. Yeah, daxibotulinum toxin started blooming. Daxistabilizing protein isn't human. RTP004 brings something to the table because it keeps Daxify room temperature stable. Now, rambobotulinum toxin, that's a B. Myoblox is a talk for cervical D. That's dystonia. And all of the other toxins end with A, 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 except for Rhyma because that's a B. Because Rhyma is Busta Rhymes for Myoblox. Starts with a B.
Woo!
So, thank Thank you. I put some thought and effort into that. Thank you very much. So now I shall review Daxify. So we're going to talk about Daxify just to kind of bring some information forward about why it's different from other toxins. I don't have any skin in the game with this. I actually have not yet been trained on Daxify. I would love to. I would love to teach my residents how to do this. I just got to figure out exactly how that goes forward. But we are going to now review this article about Daxibotulinum Toxin A, a comprehensive review by authors Nicole Salam and Jeffrey Dover out of Emory and Yale. This was published in July of 2023. Botulinum toxin A, produced by Clostridium botulinum, is widely used for aesthetic indications. It is safe and effective, but also temporary. The traditional forms of botulinum toxin require repeat injections every 3 to 4 months for maintenance of effect, but a lot of patients would love for it to last longer, as would many of us physicians. And so in 2022, in September, the FDA approved Daxibotulinum toxin A for injection as the first long-lasting botulinum toxin A formulation with a 150 kilodalton botulinum toxin A that is actually synthesized, and a proprietary stabilizing excipient peptide called RTP-004 in the place of human serum albumin. So it is unique from the beginning in that it doesn't have human serum albumin, and the rest of the toxins that we use do. The Daxify is approved to treat the moderate to severe glabellar lines, and the median duration of effect was 6 months, lasting as long as 9 months in some patients. The reason for the prolonged effectiveness is the novel botulinum toxin, as well as the carrier protein, and we'll go over some of the characteristics that make that possible. As we know, the first botulinum toxin, Botox, was approved in 1989 for glabellar rites. It's been we've come a long way, baby, with these botulinum toxins. They work, of course, by blocking neurotransmitter release at the neuromuscular junction and preventing the formation of deep facial lines. But it isn't permanent, so you have to do repeat injections every 3 to 4 months, and patients would like to have them last longer. So that's what Daxify is kind of built to satisfy that need. It is the first botulinum toxin A entirely produced and formulated in the U.S., and it has a unique biochemical structure. So it has a highly purified 150 kilodalton core botulinum toxin A and the proprietary synthetic stabilizing peptide RTP-004. It also has some surfactants, buffers, and sugars in there. The unit definition, based on testing the biologic activity of the proprietary product with individualized patients, renders the conversion to other botulinum toxin units kind of impossible. So you can't say, like you would with, you know, Dysport versus Botox, that this many units of Daxify is equivalent to this many units of Botox. So you kind of have to learn how to use it. They have had difficulty standardizing that because of the testing of the biologic activity on the proprietary product with the individualized referencing standard. And so I haven't found that that's possible, but like I said, I haven't been trained on it yet. So if somebody has a great conversion method, we would love to hear from you. Please reach out to us on social media or by email, and we would be very happy to share your wisdom. The excipient protein, the RTP-004, is pretty unique. It's a 35 amino acid, highly positively charged peptide that's used in the place of human serum albumin. Human serum albumin is used with the other neurotoxins to prevent Botox from aggregating or absorbing onto the glass surfaces. So it is to keep it available to go into solution when you hydrate the product. It fulfills the role by stabilizing the daxibotulinum toxin by strong electrostatic bonds, and the core domain is 15 lysine residues that are flanked by a protein transduction domain. The positive charge of the amino acids in the protein transduction domain form non-covalent electrostatic interactions with the negatively charged surface of the core botulinum toxin that prevents aggregation, so you don't need the human serum albumin. And because you don't need the human serum albumin, then the Daxi can be stable at room temperature for up to 3 years before reconstitution. So that's quite a long time of stability at room temperature.
I found something on the internet, so you know it's right, that says one daxibotulinum toxin unit is like equivalent to half a Botox, so you need twice as much Daxify to get the same amount of Botox.
And I would say that's probably correct given the units that they give for treatment optimization later in the article, but having not used it personally, I can't speak with authority about that.
Have you looked into the price? Maybe you're going to get to that.
I haven't. I would love for you to talk about the price, actually. You have a very savvy way of handling those things.
Cost effectiveness, so, right?
Exactly. You would want
to know the incremental cost effectiveness ratio.
I'm on board. So the RTP-004 also helps to improve the efficacy and durability of the product. And a very interesting thing about the charges here on the carrier protein and then the Botox itself, the negative charge of the botulinum toxin itself and the positive charge of the carrier protein allows the DAXI to bind the negative neurons and extracellular matrix, which may facilitate localization of the product to the area that we're trying to treat, which is the neuromuscular junction, and reduce diffusion from injection sites. So that might be a potential benefit. The study for glabellar lines looked at about 3,000 subjects who underwent over 4,000 DAXI treatments, and they had a dose escalation study that was done with 20, 40, and 60 units of onabotulinum toxin, of DAXXIFY to onabotulinum toxin 20 units or placebo. And they did two phase 3 pivotal trials and one large phase 3 open label study to look at the safety and efficacy of the drug. They found improved efficacy, prolonged and sustained duration of up to 24 weeks before returning to none or mild glabellar line severity, and 28 weeks before returning to baseline with treatments. The results were consistent between studies. Subgroup analysis comparing the botulinum toxin treatments to patients who were treatment naive, who had prior botulinum treatment to those who were treatment naive, found similar response duration and tolerance to DAXI. So they didn't find that if somebody had had prior toxin exposure that they had a diminished response to DAXXIFY. And data showed greater efficacy with DAXI 40 units compared to onabotulinum toxin 20 units. So what you were saying about like a 2-to-1 ratio there sounds like it might be correct. And there's potentially the increased efficacy for smaller amounts of the neurotoxin because of those negative and positive charge interactions. They also have had promising results from the glabellar lines clinical program and also looking at forehead lines and eyebrow position. So there was an open label dose escalating trial to look at forehead lines after glabellar treatment and found that patients who had been treated had none to mild forehead line severity, with doses ranging from 12 to 30 units. And the mean time for loss of effectiveness was 20 weeks for 18 units, 24 units and 34 unit dosing. So there was, I think, some good efficacy in both of those regions as well. I think that adverse events are similar to other toxins: erythema, facial discomfort, headache. Those are pretty typical. No patients experienced eyelid ptosis. They also had a larger study that had studied higher levels of the botulinum toxin for glabellar lines, and they found eyelid ptosis in only 0.9% of treatments. So I think your take-home points are that the unique aspect of DAXI, it's entirely formulated in the United States. It has a synthetic excipient RTP-004 instead of human serum albumin, which gives it room temperature stability for up to 3 years and also potentially decreases the immunogenicity of the product. And it has potentially a longer lasting effectiveness. Now, you are using more product than you would be using for Botox. And so some people have, you know, argued that if you use the similar dose of Botox, then you would achieve greater longevity as well. I haven't done a, forgive the fun, but head-to-head study. Get it? It's funnier because we do most of the Botox on the head.
That is funny.
I am hilarious. So I think the other valuable thing out of this article is they have a very nice table that compares and contrasts the different cosmetic neuromodulators. That was what inspired me to formulate the little wrap at the beginning of this discussion. And I think highlighting the differences there, looking at the sizes of it. What's interesting to me is that the smaller botulinum toxins, so both incobotulinum toxin and daxibotulinum toxin are 150 kilodaltons, whereas onabotulinum toxin, abobotulinum toxin, and prabotulinum toxin are between 500 and 900 kilodaltons. And so these small stealthy ones are able to be more room stabilized. So there was some very nice information, I think, brought forward from this article. I'd love to have some personal experience treating patients with DAXXIFY so I can make my own comparisons. It's always nice to have new products on the pipeline. There's also a new Botox that's going to be coming to the market if it kind of continues on its current trajectory that is actually able to be shipped hydrated. So it's actually liquid it doesn't have to be reconstituted. So that's a kind of new, exciting development in that arena. And I think that they'll continue to workshop on this product line because it is such a useful modality to treat aging and also other kinds of cosmetic concerns. Patients also get improvement in rosacea. Some patients, of course, we use it for hyperhidrosis. I've have some patients that we use it for certain types of hair loss. So there's a lot of applications for Botox. I think that we'll continue to learn more about how to use it and have new products developed as we go along.
So it sounds like it lasts about twice as long as Botox. So a shortcut is it's like double Botox. You need twice as much, but it lasts for twice as long.
I like that, Luke. I love the simplicity of it.
So this is actually a perfect case study, I think, for this like cost effectiveness thing. This is not fulfilling an unmet need. We already have plenty of botulinum toxins, so many that there has to be a table and a rap song to keep
them
straight.
I know. And it was a relatively long rap song. I'm quite proud of myself. I didn't really mess up during that.
So is this really something? I mean, we can argue about whether we, quote, need cosmetic products, I guess. But our conversation with Steve Feldman and the Halo Effect suggests that we do. But is this just a Me Too product? Is this some other company that's trying to get in on the Botox market or something? Is it worth it? I mean, it does seem better. So if we quickly try to figure out its ICER value, I'm going to use the lower values that I found online. So a unit of Botox, perhaps $10 if you get it at a fairly inexpensive price. And then for botulinum toxin, it looks like about $15 per unit, again, at the low end. But you need twice as many,
twice
right?
As much, yeah.
So if you need 2 units of the Daxi to get 1 unit of the Botox, then it's $30 versus $10. Okay, so it's 3 times as expensive, but it lasts twice as long. So in that sense, you go from $30 to $15 per unit. So to get the same length of time, because you would need an extra Botox injection 3 months from now, but you don't if you got the daxibotulinum toxin. So it's still more expensive. However, we can say, well, now you save money by not having to take time to go to the clinic in 3 months and get another injection. And if you have a job or other responsibilities and you would be taking time away from those, then maybe that's valuable. Also, we don't have to pay some injector to inject you that second time. You are also driving, presumably, to this clinic and burning gas and all that stuff. So maybe it does end up being a wash or possibly even more cost effective. See, interesting stuff. You can argue different ways. And if you've got a particular axe to grind one way or another, it allows you to manipulate some of the numbers to come up with what you want, which is probably a little bit of a problem with the approach, too. But I think it is, as I said, the best we've got, and again, something we should be paying more attention to.
I agree.
Okay, so something completely different. Well, actually, not that different. Still photo, like cost-effectiveness stuff. So phototherapy, pretty cost-effective treatment for psoriasis, especially compared to some of these biologics, and also for other treatments as well, or other diseases as well. I will say, since dupilumab has been approved, my rates of having phototherapy approved by insurance has gone up dramatically. And from their standpoint, it makes a lot of sense. They can spend $10,000 once for a patient's home phototherapy device, or they can spend $3,000 every month for potentially ever on dupilumab. So phototherapy, pretty good treatment option, as long as it works with your patient's schedules, or perhaps they have a home unit. Can you make it work even better? Perhaps you can if you have an emollient. It seems that most of the work done on this topic is fairly old, like 10 to 20 years old, but I think still relevant and perhaps worth unearthing. So this is a review I'm going to discuss from the JAAD from the year 2013. The title is The Impact of Emollients on Phototherapy, a review. The chief authors are Manuela Astolos and John Koo, and they are from the University of Arizona and from UCSF. So in this review, they discovered that some emollients allow greater penetration of UVB rays, thus enhancing the effects of phototherapy, and other emollients did the opposite. Their review suggests most of this stuff is mostly relevant for psoriasis, perhaps because psoriatic plaques are thick and scaly and they reflect light, and it's difficult for light to penetrate all the way to the base where a lot of the therapeutic value lies, sort of at the epidermal basal layer. And this review just focused specifically on psoriasis. They found that thin oil-based emollients like mineral oil, Vaseline oil, not Vaseline petroleum jelly, but something called Vaseline oil, and glycerin allowed for better UV penetration. The thin oil-based products kind of sunk in between the cracks on the scales, and perhaps that was part of the reason why they worked better. Thick products, like my beloved petrolatum, as well as salicylic acid, actually made things worse.
Oh, no.
They block some of the UV rays. In fact, some of these could be sort of like a mild sunscreen. It turns out that salicylic acid is similar in molecular structure to para-aminobenzoic acid, which is one of our chemical sunscreens. Who knew? Also of practical relevance, there is a separate CPT code for phototherapy if you put an emollient on beforehand, at least 5 minutes in advance, and it reimburses more. So institutions out there, you can use code 96910 rather than 96900 if you're putting an emollient on, and probably get paid more. And it kind of makes sense that it's reimbursed more, because if it works better, patients will have fewer treatments, there will be less adverse effects to the surrounding skin, assuming you're putting the emollient on just to the areas of the skin disease. And you can use that code whether the patient has psoriasis or something else, but there's a lot less data for something like atopic dermatitis about whether or not the emollient makes a difference. Though, of course, we know that patients with atopic dermatitis should be putting on emollients anyway. From a practical standpoint, mineral oil is a lot messier than petroleum jelly. So even though it works better, you might have to like put towels on the floor or something. They might be kind of drippy. Of course, the patients can put it on themselves, assuming they don't have limited mobility or something. By the way, how does phototherapy work? Well, a few different ways. It works by reducing epidermal hyperproliferation, by reducing angiogenesis, and acting as an immunosuppressor. It also temporarily decreases the synthesis of DNA, RNA, and proteins that regulate cell turnover, and it reduces the number of Langerhans cells in the skin, thereby decreasing antigen presentation. So there you go. Something simple that might pay you more and also work better. So another good cost-effectiveness tie-in.
I love that.
Speaking of things that tie in, let's talk about like little threads that you can use to tie things.
Ooh, well done. Like I'm gonna you get a salute for that one. That was well done. So we're gonna talk about the thing that you dread to see on your schedule, because we've all had a traumatic experience with this. And
but
you guys
let me
know
point
what's
out
coming.
Before you get started, Michelle, because I can see a significant gaping rabbit hole opening before us. Okay. You got about 10 minutes.
Ah, okay, you're right. Okay, I'll be as quick as I can. So we're going to talk about Morgellons disease. So first, I want to start with empathy. Every patient I have ever seen with Morgellons, delusions of parasitosis, infestational delusions, whatever you want to call it, they are truly and genuinely suffering. And I genuinely believe none of them are doing it on purpose. I think that they are experiencing a very isolating and very traumatizing experience. And unfortunately, a lot of their contact with the medical system seeking help for this condition is also traumatizing, stigmatizing, and shaming. And so I want to start from a position of empathy, but also acknowledge how difficult it is to help provide effective care to these patients. And I think one of the reasons for that is that this condition, this whole basket of conditions, is poorly understood, ill-defined, and contains a lot of things that present similarly that are actually pathophysiologically very different from each other and need different treatments. And I think that that's why one of the reasons why this is such a hard condition to treat. So Morgellons disease, as we know, is disfiguring, it's perplexing. Patients may complain of multicolored filaments that emerge from their skin. We don't understand it very well, but it occurs all over the country. And as we're going to see looking at this article, also has occurred over legions of time. It has the potential presentation of spontaneously appearing ulcerative skin lesions with unusual filaments resembling textile fibers that may be many different colors. So that's kind of where we're going to start. Now let's look at the history. So the first iteration of the word Morgellons came from a letter written in 1674 by Sir Thomas Browne, who was an English physician describing a skin disease in French children that he characterized as having harsh hairs on their backs, which appeared to give them relief from symptoms like coughs and convulsions. This is the beginning of the description that the authors sort of point to argue that many patients who have what we call Morgellons disease, especially if there's the associated presentation of perforating fibers, may actually have an undiagnosed treponemal or spirochetal infection. And so there have been presentations through periods of history that have had some alignment with what we now call Morgellons disease. In 1894, Thiberge described something called acarophobia for patients who believed that they had skin infested with parasites. That term was later replaced with delusions of parasitosis in 1946. There was an important narrative by Ekbom in 1938, who published a series of case studies describing patients with a sensation of movement and the belief that insects were crawling on or under the skin. Some of Ekbom's patients actually had documented cases of syphilis, which, as we know, is spirochetal. Moving into the modern age, and I think the time period when the concept of Morgellons sort of caught fire, if you will, was with a biologist named Mary Lieto, who noticed non-healing lesions with embedded fibers on her son's skin. And she appropriated the name Morgellons from Brown's description and founded the Morgellons Research Foundation, the MRF, to investigate the condition. There were enough patients that kind of joined the discussion through both the MRF website and through other pathways that CDC in 2006 put together a task force to investigate Morgellons disease. In 2012, they concluded their investigation with the findings that Morgellons disease was similar to delusional infestation or delusions of parasitosis, but this was controversial at the time. Recently, some rigorous experimental investigations have shown that Morgellons disease may result from a physiologic response to the presence of an infectious agent, specifically spirochetal organisms. And some studies have found an association between Morgellons disease and spirochetal infections in humans, cattle, and dogs. And there are presentations in animals that also can potentially present with these perforating fibers. Now, the concept of perforating fibers modified by metabolism or infection isn't foreign to us. If we think about trichodysplasia spinulosa, that's caused by a polyoma virus, the trichodysplasia spinulosa virus, that causes strange filaments to emerge from hair follicles because of viral modification of the process of making trichohyalin in the hair shaft. The authors in this paper suggest that these fibers are actually keratin and collagen that are being synthesized by intracellularly infected keratinocytes or fibroblasts in response to infection with spirochetal organisms, which are notoriously difficult to detect. Most of the investigations that have been well done have found that the fibers patients present with are not textile fibers. Now, for clarity, this doesn't mean the fibers you can see with your naked eye stuck to a crusty scab. Those are textile fibers. The fibers that they're describing in this paper are very, very small, requiring 50x magnification to see them. So if you can see them with an unassisted eye, we're not talking about these filaments.
Wait a sec, but those are the filaments that the patients complain about.
Those are the filaments that the patients complain about. But the sensation may be attributable to microscopically visible filamentous changes. So they may be seeing the consequence of having an eroded skin lesion and wearing clothing, but feeling the true consequence of modified biology, if that makes
sense. Sounds like a reach, Michelle.
I agree. I think that you have to be very specific here because what we call Morgellons, delusions of parasitosis, is a broad category of things that catches a bunch of different diagnoses. When I see a patient with any kind of delusions of parasitosis, sensations of formication, any of these things, I find that they tend to fall into a couple of different categories. So the first category, and the one that I think is actually the hardest one to treat, is patients who have a strong history of substance abuse, specifically methamphetamines. Reproducible production of skin ulcerations with concurrent methamphetamine abuse is something that you can see in both humans and experimental animals. Patients have a tendency to hyperfocus on things when they're exposed to amphetamine-type substances. Even children that we put on Adderall for things like ADHD may demonstrate eyebrow plucking, finger picking, onychotillomania, those kinds of things, as response to the hyperstimulation. So I think that there are some patients where this presentation is substance-related. We also know that stimulants such as cocaine can create the sensation of formication on the skin, and those patients can have complications that arise from then colonization of the open wounds with bacteria, which produce pruritogens, so they become even more itchy. They can spread the bacterial infection to other open areas of the skin, and it can be a self-reinforcing problem. So I think there's substance-related, which the authors, to their credit, say those patients don't have Morgellons disease. Those patients have a substance-related skin condition. I think there are patients that have dementia that have the interpretation of the sensation of itch as having to be originating from a microorganism, a bite, some kind of thing infesting or biting them, because our brains are constantly trying to explain to us the world that we live in. So if we're feeling itching, we can't explain, and it's pervasive and it's all the time, our brains are going to be looking for an explanation for this. In theater, we talk about the slouch toward narrative. So with the slouch toward narrative, what we do is if you have a class on acting, very often the exercise will be that you'll come into the room and there will be, for example, an older woman sitting at a table by herself, sort of starkly lit. And the instructor will ask, "What do you see?" And because humans love to tell themselves stories, people will come up with a lot of explanations. "I see a widow sitting at a table after she's lost her husband. I see a mother waiting up for her child. I see a woman who is lonely and thinking about committing suicide." Something, you know, you tell yourself a story. And then the instructor is supposed to keep asking, "What do you see? What do you see? What do you see?" Until somebody realizes that we're being asked, "What do you see?" Not "What do you interpret?" And somebody will say, "I see a woman sitting at a table by herself." And that's the end of the exercise. We build explanations for everything that happens to us in our day-to-day life. We see this happen in relationships where people make assumptions about why somebody behaves a certain way. Like somebody forgets to pick up the dry cleaning, and then somebody interprets it as, "You forgot to do that on purpose so that my day would be difficult," or something like that. So we tend to explain things to ourselves. If a person has a brain that's not working, if they have dementia and they have chronic itching, it's very understandable that their brain's explanation to themselves about what's going on there is going to be that they're getting bitten by insects. I think that happens with other things that cause diminished mental acuity. I think that this can also be something that presents with chronic pruritus of any origin over time, because the patient is just desperate for relief and then for understanding.
So, and then sorry, this spirochetal thing. So mm-hmm. I agree with all that stuff about our delusions of parasitosis patients in general. Mm-hmm. It sounds like these authors are saying that Morgellons disease, at least some of the people who have it, they actually do have a medical disease, which is caused by Lyme disease or some other spirochete, and yes. We shouldn't dismiss them. We should, I suppose, test or treat them for those things?
Well, exactly. And I think that the main thrust of the article is that we should always look for the cause of the pruritus, mitigate it if possible, and keep our mind open to the possibility that it is an unusual presentation of an infection. So for clarity, I think the vast majority of people who present with delusions of parasitosis either have a substance-related skin condition, they have a condition where their mental acuity is compromised and their body's explaining itching to them in a way that is normal in context of a person's normal life experience. And then there's a very much smaller proportion of patients who may have a spirochetal infection. Those would be the people who you could identify these very small fibers that require 50x magnification to see and might be visible on histology. Having personally seen a lot of histologic slides where you see viral modification of protein synthesis, I think this is a potential explanation for some patients. And we also know that spirochetal illnesses can produce spontaneous skin ulcers. We see that in things like syphilis and yaws. So I don't think it's beyond the scope of possibility that some patients who present with what gets called delusions of parasitosis have truly got some kind of spirochetal illness that is creating modified extrusions of skin fibers or perforating type disorder. And so I think that those are also possible. I think there's also a group of patients that have a metabolic dyscrasia that creates chronic pruritus and abnormal connective tissue that might be a nidus for inflammation and irritation. And that, you know, any person who's subjected to chronic pruritus has a understandable explanation for why they might develop psychiatric trouble, because chronic itching is like torture. Like if you've never experienced a period of chronic pruritus, you don't know what these patients go through. I had chronic spontaneous urticaria after COVID. And, you know, I've always had empathy for people who suffer from urticaria. But after I went through that experience, not knowing when I was going to be itching all the time, especially when I was trying to go to bed, trying to mitigate it with antihistamines that made me very sleepy. Like it's a very difficult thing to manage. And when it's chronic and it's every day, it's like water torture. It is just kind of beats away a little bit at your ability to cope with things. And I can completely understand why it could cause anxiety and depression, and even under certain circumstances, psychosis. If the patient does have a spirochetal infection, those can actually also cause psychiatric symptoms. They can cause severe fatigue. They can cause also joint pain and neuropathy, which some patients who present with what we call Morgellons disease do have. So my take-home points from this article are: when you're confronted with a patient who tells you that they have bugs in their skin, to first keep an open mind, an open heart, and open eyes. So you want to really look at the patient individually. Does this patient have a metabolic disorder that's modifying their collagen and making them itchy, that's causing them to have like a perforating disorder, or that's causing them to have chronic pruritus? Does this patient have a treatable diagnosis? Do they have atopic dermatitis? Do they have the atopic diathesis that elderly patients tend to develop? There are good articles that have actually shown that when you treat a patient who has delusions of parasitosis with Dupixent, they actually improve. I think that there will also be some similar studies done with some of the JAK inhibitors to show that when you relieve the itching, the pervasive thoughts about having an infestation go away, because the patient is just trying to understand their human experience. And when their human experience is that all day, every day, I'm itching constantly, I feel like something's biting me all the time, they're going to understandably explain that to themselves, that they're being bitten. So I think that having that open mind, open heart, and open eyes when you're taking care of patients with DOP is going to be the best therapeutic approach. Now, I realize that patients who have this condition have had unfortunate experiences often in the medical community and are looking for an answer. I also understand that we're trying to make their suffering better without making their attachment to the non-helpful thought stronger. So we're trying to prevent hardening of the delusion without showing them any kind of like hardness about it, without showing them any kind of disdain around their presentation. My approach to patients who come in with concerns about insects biting them is I first acknowledge how much they're suffering. I can tell that this is really compromising your quality of life. You've distanced yourself from your family. You're sleeping in a different bed than your wife. You're avoiding activities. I can tell this is costing you a lot, and it's really, really disrupting your life. We talk about what we can and can't do. I think that it's always reasonable to offer the patient a biopsy. I always let them select the location. If I feel like it's a good place for the biopsy, that's the place that we would consider doing it. We do a thorough history and physical exam to make sure that there's not an underlying medical issue that needs to be treated. And then we discuss the different kind of therapies that we can offer. There are still going to be patients that are going to be angry that you can't tell them that they have bugs. There are some people who just want to be cured from the suffering they're going through. And I think that this is one of the hardest things that we do in our specialty. But if we approach it with empathy and curiosity and kindness, I think the vast majority of the time we can at least help the patients cope with it better.
So how do you deal with it? I'm on board with empathy. So let's just skip past that part now and go back to this business where these authors are arguing against this finding that Morgellons is a subset of delusional parasitosis. Mm-hmm. So these authors, there are three of them. One is from a veterinary services area. Mm-hmm. Only one of them is a physician. Mm-hmm. I think there's a microbiologist and a nurse practitioner, and then Dr. Ralph Stricker looks like he's an internal medicine doctor. And I think this group probably has its own particular biases, which is fair. We need iconoclasts to challenge the way we think about things. Dr. Stricker was past president of the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society.
True.
So Lyme disease kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like their argument is that at least in some patients, this Morgellons could be a manifestation of one of these Lyme disease, mm-hmm. possibly other spirochetal infections as well. The journal that published this article is called Clinical Cosmetic and Investigational Dermatology. So
I did look that up to see if it was on Beale's list, because as I was reading it, I also perceived that there might be some bias in there, especially toward the diagnosis of Lyme disease. It wasn't on the Beale's list for predatory journals. It has an impact factor of 2.5, the journal it's published in. For reference, the JADS impact factor is usually above 13 or 14. So it's not one of our highest impact journals. And I certainly don't think that every patient that has DOP has Lyme disease. I think keeping your eyes, ears, and mind open is reasonable. I think that if a patient has a provocative history for the potential acquisition of Lyme disease, especially prior to the onset of symptoms, then it would merit an investigation. The authors do highlight the fact that the traditionally used screening test for Lyme disease, which is a two-step testing process, may miss some infections. And that was one of the things that sort of made me raise my eyebrows, despite the botulinum toxin, about, you know, where do you stop? When do you stop testing? You know, how many levels of testing do you do for each patient? And that also kind of keys into the cost of healthcare thing. Taking care of patients with any kind of delusions of parasitosis, or patients, I'd like to frame it just as patients who believe they have bugs in their skin. So when you're taking care of patients who believe they have bugs in their skin, that care can be costly both from a time and healthcare resource standpoint, because you cannot actually disprove a delusion. That's kind of impossible. What you can do is give the patient information and let them come to their own conclusions about that. But you can do a $1 million workup on a patient who has a firm and fixed belief that they have bugs in their skin, and they can still believe with every fiber of their being that they do have bugs in their skin. We just can't find them. So I don't know that
fiber of their being
with every fiber of their being. Ha ha ha. But what I do think would be more fruitful is focusing on how we can improve the symptoms that are driving the belief, right? Because if the itch goes away, then the impetus to believe that one is infested with some kind of invisible insect could also wane. So I think that
I'm still
focus
interested in this Lyme disease thing. I feel you're trying to move past it.
Well, I think that it's possible that some patients who present with these symptoms could have a spirochetal infection. I think it's one of the many things we have to keep our minds open to. I don't think that every patient, by any stretch of the imagination, that has the presentation of believing they have insects in their skin has Lyme disease, but it's a possibility. And I do think that we owe it to the patients to try to find the cause of their suffering and mitigate it. I don't think that the strategy of trying to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a person doesn't have infections is a viable one, because like I said, you could spend every healthcare dollar that exists and do every test that is known to man. But if the patient's still itching and feeling like they're getting bitten, or like they have things crawling under their skin every day, they're not going to believe you that they don't have bugs in their skin. So I think that finding the underlying pathology and treating for symptom relief is still the most viable strategy. I think that for patients that have an identifiable psychiatric disorder, appropriate referral to psychiatric help is always a good idea. Many of these patients are very resistant to that because they've been told, either directly or indirectly, this is all in your head, you're crazy. And so when they hear, I need you to see a psychiatrist, they feel like they're being sort of passed over to someone to fix their head, to, you know, kind of get in there and tinker around and fix the broken thought process instead of solve the problem that they've come to you for. And so there's distrust there. I have found that approaching that discussion from the standpoint of, I can see how much distress this is causing you. I can see how much disruption this has caused in your life. We're going to work on getting this better and more manageable. But in the meantime, I'd like for you to have some coping skills to deal with this extra stress that you have to deal with every day so that you can have the best quality of life possible while we look for answers. And
well,
I found
it's hard to be convinced here that Morgellons disease is sometimes caused by Lyme disease. But I mean, I won't say it's impossible. So I agree with your comment that it's possible. My impression is that this like chronic Lyme stuff that some patients comment on is still pretty fringe in terms of
it
medicine.
Absolutely.
There are some physicians and there are some patients who believe strongly that it's a thing, but I think the establishment generally doesn't think so. And perhaps we can all agree that we just need better tests, I suppose.
Yes, I think that's true.
Perhaps it's not crazy to like give somebody a few weeks of doxycycline just to see if that somehow works, especially if they've been camping or something. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I think focusing on this empathy stuff is probably the biggest answer.
And it's, you know, it's a very difficult problem. It's a heterogeneous problem. We have a lot of similar presentations of very different pathologies, right? So is this substance related? Is this metabolic disease? Is this atopy? Or is this actually an infection? You know, there are multiple different groups underneath this one unifying presentation of, I feel like I have bugs in my skin. And I think that that's one of the reasons that it's both so challenging and so frustrating to treat. But if you can sort of work through a little bit of an algorithm to rule out things that you can at least do something about, and then focus on symptom relief and support, I think that most patients can find some benefit from that. There are always going to be those patients that want you to tell them that they are a very, very special person who has indeed been infested with special sparkly unicorn bugs that live under their skin and only their skin, and they're the only one that knows about them. And there's, you know, something that some patients key into about that identity of, this is the kind of thing that only happens to me, right? But I think the vast majority of patients just want to feel better and live a normal life. And so for those patients who have that goal, I think that you can find pathways toward relief, if not cure, at least relief, so that they can live a life with some quality.
Amen. Let's crawl out of this rabbit hole and let the sun shine on us for a moment, at least.
I like it.
With sunscreen. So thanks for joining us today, friends. This has been some interesting discussion time. Thanks to our institutions, of course. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. And thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. Thanks to all of the members of Team Dermosphere, a group of motivated medical and pre-medical students who keep things moving along behind the scenes. They include Laura Dela Cruz, Jordan Easterling, Austin Callister, Nicole Babkowski, Lior Lavin, Justin Lyon, and Kripa Ahuja. Among other things, they maintain our website. You can find us at dermospherepodcast.com, which has links to all of the original articles and is also a housing location for our entire archive. It's also a good way to reach out to us. You can also find us on X, Instagram, and Facebook. Also some video content on YouTube and ViewMedi, again, thanks to Team Dermosphere. And friends, if you feel that this podcast has brought some value to your lives and you would like to provide some value to us, you can donate to the podcast at uofuhealth.org/dermosphere. Friends, you are always welcome to join the University of Utah Dermatology Echo Sessions the second Friday of every month. There should be a link in the show notes. And if you'd like to hang out with me in person on Friday, May 24th, we have a practical dermatology all-day seminar here in Salt Lake City. Again, thanks so much for hanging out today, guys. And we'll see you in 2 weeks.